we've been going on for 32 episodes now about cultural humility. And so the question arises, what does it look like for me to be a culturally humble person? How do I know if I'm culturally humble? That's what we're going to talk about today on the All Things All People podcast. Let's get to it. Welcome back to the All Things to All People podcast with Michael Burns. I am Michael Burns, and we are continuing to go through my book, All Things to All People, The Power of Cultural Humility. And we are in the last section of the book, the section known as Moving Forward, and we're on chapter 23 today, which is entitled The Culturally Competent Person. And that's really what we're going to focus on today is what does it look like to be culturally humble? We've, you know, gone through many facets of it. But what does that mean? And cultural humility is such a central part of being a Christian. To review a little bit, if we are called to be the gathering of the nations, go make disciples of all nations, then a key component of that is to be all things to all people, to be inclusive, to understand the cultures, the backgrounds, the experiences, and the histories of one another. This is not just something that a small select few or just a professional clergy or ministers are called to do, but it's something that we're all called to embrace and go after, and in varying degrees. Some people will be better at it, pursue it more than others, but it is something that we are all called to go after. So that's what we're going to get into today, and let's just go ahead and jump right into the reading. The culturally competent person. Paul grew up loving his own culture and people. There's little question about that. As he wrote a letter to the people of Philippi, he called them to imitate Christ rather than the culture around them. Yes, all they saw around them were people striving for social mobility, praise from others, and doing whatever they could to advance themselves and get ahead. And yes, in Roman eyes, humility was considered a weakness, while being self-determinant was considered the greatest freedom. But Paul called them to lay down and follow Christ, which meant giving up selfish ambition, embracing humility, and acting in the interest of others in all situations. As Paul is laying out the challenge of this call and reminding them of men whose lives exemplified that very way of living, he turns his attention to what they will have to give. In so doing, we get a small glimpse into the cultural world that Paul was raised in. As a Jew who grew up as part of the diaspora, meaning his family had been scattered outside Palestine, he was still steeped in Jewish culture. He was born into the right tribe and trained in all things Jewish. His family followed customs to the letter and embraced it all. After moving to Jerusalem, he continued not only following God, but learning and excelling in every aspect of Jewish cultural life. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews, Philippians 3:5. And when it came to the connection for the Gentile nations, and when it came to the connection the Gentile nations had with the one true Creator, Paul didn't have a high opinion of non-Jewish people. So when he was confronted by the resurrected Christ and had a hole blown in his worldview, we might be more than a little surprised at his response when Paul suddenly realized that he was the long-promised King of Israel and of the world. He dedicated his life to proclaiming that to whomever would hear the proclaiming that to whomever would hear the message. He was willing to take that message around the world and declare it to Jew and Gentile alike. Based on this upbringing, though, if anyone would have connected the gospel to the Jewish culture, we might have suspected Paul to be at the top of the list. Yet, he was just the opposite. The Judaizers were the group that could not separate the gospel of Jesus from their own cultural preferences and background. In their failure to do so, they created what Paul called a different gospel, one in which following the law and the customs of the Jewish people became required for the Christ follower. Marrying the good news of Jesus to any cultural practices or preferences is to create a different gospel. We must rely on Christ alone, but there's a second danger in conflating Christ and any specific culture. When we do that, the mission to gather the nations becomes endangered. It means that embracing the gospel suddenly becomes as much about being willing to cast off your cultural beliefs and perspectives and embracing a new default culture as it is about entering God's kingdom. God's kingdom is pliable to any culture. It does not have a default human culture, not even Jewish. It will welcome and adapt to any culture, but will also challenge any person to both bring their culture into the kingdom and to adapt parts of it to the standards of kingdom living. And I'll break in right here for just a moment and say this is a bigger challenge perhaps than we realize, because it's just human nature to live according to our culture, to embrace our culture, and to, for many cultures, especially in the case of kind of Western American culture, to think that it's the best, while at the same time not really thinking about the fact that we are dominating others with our culture. We just expect them to accept it. Because we've so conflated our culture in many ways with the right way to do things, with Christianity. And so it's really hard for us to separate in many ways what is Christian versus what is our culture and our cultural version of Christianity. And so, I've seen a lot of times where the West, and especially Americans more recently, have planted churches or whatever, and they look culturally like to be a Christian, you have to be American. You have to accept these aspects of our culture, and this is how you worship, and this is how you do things. But those are really more American than Christian. And so we've got to make sure that we do what Paul did, which is be able to distinguish between our culture and the kingdom of God. Back to the reading here. For Paul, the gospel allowed for and even demanded cultural flexibility. Disciples would lay down their lives for the benefit of others and would be willing to become all things to all people, 1 Corinthians 9:22. We see Paul's heart for that clearly when he ambled into Athens, the center of Greek culture, to proclaim that Jesus was king and that there was a new way to live in response to that, Acts 17, 16 through 34. Paul earned the ear of many who were present that day because he was not a cultural elitist. He was troubled at their idolatry, but he still respected these people. There's not a hint of disdain for them or their culture. In fact, he had paid close attention to their culture. He knew how to operate in it. He didn't assume negative intent in their actions, but praised the intent of having an altar to an unknown god, as misguided as he thought that was. He knew something about their customs and their values and was able to quote some of their poetry. Paul was a student of culture, and because he was able to transcend the culture and become like these Greeks to a degree to help win some to the gospel. He didn't teach them a mixture of Christianity with a heavy dose of Jewish culture. He declared to them that Jesus was king in a way that they could understand and live out in their own context. Would they have to change aspects of their lives to follow him? Of course, we all do. But they didn't have to become Jewish. Paul was unquestionably a culturally competent person. Paul was culturally humble. That's the point. Let's go on to the next section. Getting started. Back in the days before GPS navigation, when we used MapQuest to get around, I printed out directions for returning from the house of an out-of-state friend I was visiting. And let me just say this. Do you remember having to do that? Like, print out MapQuest directions? Like, oh, it just seems like the dark ages now. It seemed so incredible at the time. And now I look back and I'm like, what was the point even of that? If you take one wrong turn, the MapQuest directions are now largely useless unless you figure out how to get back to the point where you took the wrong turn and where you are in the directions. And, oh, it's just a mess. Just a mess. Shortly after leaving, though, I had a problem. I couldn't figure out the directions, nor could I find the highway I needed to take. I wandered around a bit and realized that now, not only did I not know where I was going, I wasn't sure I could find my way back to my friend's house. It turns out I had the wrong starting address, so the directions were never going to help me. Having the right starting point is essential because everything else we do will flow from there. If we want to become culturally competent disciples, where do we start? What is the first step in becoming all things to all people? Paul says, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone. I have become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. 1 Corinthians 9, 19 and 22. Paul understood that he was free and not under compulsion to adapt and modify his own cultural practices and preferences for the benefit of others. He then set about intentionally doing so. He was able to make that observation and begin to adapt himself because he was aware of his own cultural tendencies and how they differed from others. Paul's first step was to be aware of and know his own cultural boundaries. And I will say this, I will add this. Paul says, though I am free and not a slave to anyone, this is what I will do. I make myself a slave. So we might say, well, does that mean being culturally humble is optional? Well, kind of. But the way Paul puts it is, you don't have to do this in Christ. You're not required, because if you were required, then that would be part of your salvation, and we would be adding that to the cross in a sense, and now there's more that you have to do to be saved. So you are free. But here's the implications. If you don't, he says, I do this so that I, by all possible means, I might save some. If you don't do it, what does that mean? If you're doing it so that you can help people be saved and be part of the community, if you don't do it, then you run the risk of not helping those people be saved or turning them off or creating obstacles for them to become a Christian. So, while not absolutely required for salvation, it is a central and necessary part to be the most effective witnesses for the gospel that we can be. Let's go on with the reading. If we are going to be culturally adaptive persons who are on the mission of the gospel, then our first step is self-awareness and self-analysis. This is not for the sake of identity politics, whereby we section off by groups and then stay as separate as possible, while at the same time calling for tolerance between groups, even as we constantly accentuate the differences. That is how the world has largely responded to the issues brought about by diversity. We identify our differences so that we can overcome them using Jesus' method of bending and sacrificing ourselves. This is not limited to one group within the body of Christ. We must all be willing to embrace this. And one more thought here. It might be easy to say, well, I don't want to do all this. I don't think you have to do it. Why do we have to talk about this? You don't need to. Let me put it in terms of a missionary. If I'm going to go to another country with a very different culture and I'm unfamiliar with it, I could go and totally ignore that, not pay attention to their culture, not put in the work, just here, this is Christianity, this is how we do it in my home country, this is how you have to do it. And I can be effective. Some people can be saved, but man, it puts obstacles in people's way, and man, does it limit my effectiveness. And there's an arrogance there, and that I don't have to learn about your culture. And indeed, if we look in the past, many missionaries took that approach. Many did not, but many did, and it did cause real damage in some respects. And so I think if we translate that into our own context, even if you're not a missionary, and say, man, when we live in diverse areas and so on, same dynamics are at play, same dynamics. So being culturally humble is vital. Back to the reading. Here are some areas in which we can start the self-assessment. For each topic, ask yourself how this aspect of your identity has helped to shape your cultural beliefs and practices. What are some specific cultural elements that have been grafted into your life as a result of these forces? Nationality, region, where you grew up, town or city, race or ethnicity, gender, socioeconomic status and class, religion, family. These certainly are not all the categories that have an impact on your culture, but being aware of how these things affect you is a huge start. Refer to the diagram in chapter 22 and start thinking through the many different areas of culture depicted there and how the topics above will affect each of those areas. Don't feel that you need to rush the process. Take your time at self-analysis. Calibrate your thinking. It is vitally important that we not get off track in how we mentally approach this task. In no way is anyone implying that culture is bad or inferior. Sometimes when people are asked to be flexible, they overreact and argue that they feel as though their culture is being diminished or demonized. No one is saying that. But your culture is not superior either. And that is an important takeaway. The process of becoming all things to all people is not a compulsory one. We are not called to this process because our culture is more flawed than others and it needs to be phased out. That is not about the worth or lack of worth of any... I'm having trouble reading today. Let me back up. This is not about the worth or lack of worth of any individual culture. This is about the gospel and what we've been called to do in order to keep God's mission pressing into a world that desperately needs it. A church community that does not have people willing to be pliable and culturally competent is a church that is doomed to never grow past a dominant culture. It will be the least likely group to have a truly transformed gospel culture that embraces all people because it will never escape the clutches of the default culture of that society. In order to grow, the dominant group must be willing to adjust itself and include and value other ways of doing things. In order to thrive, every group must be willing to engage in this process. Willing to learn. Once we've taken the steps to identify our own culture and understand the power it has in our life, our emotions, and our interactions with others, we can start to grow in our cultural competence. It doesn't matter how little or how much we've paid attention to this area of the gospel in the past. We can all grow from whatever our starting point is. I believe the gospel-focused person will pursue six areas in their heart. The first is a willingness to be actively aware of the culture of others. The dynamics of interplay between theirs and ours and potential sources of conflict. We won't be able to foresee every conflict or difference before it happens, but sensitivity to these issues will help us more quickly identify and work through our differences. The second is a willingness to learn. Being aware is a good start, but we need to go beyond that and put in the effort to learn the expressions and attitudes of others. This will range from everything to spending time with people of other cultures and truly inviting them into our lives and entering theirs, to taking a class on cross-cultural communication. Not everyone will need to take a special course, but everyone can intertwine their lives with brothers and sisters of different cultural groups with a willing heart to learn. The rest of the list must all be present to truly engage in the first two. As Paul teaches the church about the importance of unity in the gathering of the nations in his letter known as Ephesians, he urges that they be completely humble and gentle, be patient and bearing with one another in love, Ephesians 4:2. To be culturally proficient towards others requires humility, gentleness, patience, and love. Someone who is pursuing these four virtues in their life will find that they slot in quite naturally in becoming all things to all people. These attributes will orient our hearts toward awareness and willingness to learn. For the remainder of this chapter, we'll be more specific and move on to principles for the person striving to grow in their cultural flexibility and adaptability. Principles for personal cultural competency. What's the difference between rules and principles? Well, rules can be followed with little to no heart, thought, or effort put into it. We can go through the motions and check off the boxes. Applying principles asks more of us. It demands that we engage our heart and mind and discern how to be guided by these precepts as we react to situations that arise. Following principles is more difficult than keeping rules. When it comes to cultural competency, I will suggest 11 principles that will help us to navigate the choppy waters of the diverse community. Be curious and ask questions. In an English play from 1598, we find the first recorded use of the proverb, "Care killed the cat," by which was meant anxiety. That saying remained in use until 1898, when the first known recorded instance of the now more well-known "Curiosity killed the cat" appeared in a Galveston newspaper. Curiosity has not exactly been thought of as a virtue over the centuries, going back as far as the theologian Augustine, who wrote in 397 that God, quote, fashioned hell for the inquisitive. So, let me say this. See, you're always learning things here in the All Things to All People podcast. You didn't know where curiosity the cat phrase came from. Now you do. Has roots all the way back to 1598 and began, as far as we know, in 1898. Interesting. I'm going to propose that sometimes curiosity can be a good thing rather than just a ticket to the inferno. When we are not curious, we don't learn and won't grow. Be curious. Become a student of other cultures, especially as it relates to life within the body of Christ. Curiosity leads to the second principle, which I've included in this section. Ask lots of questions. Ask questions, and then listen with the sole intent of learning. Spend time thinking about ways to include other cultural expressions into the body of Christ as we throw off the shackles of a default dominant culture and strive toward the kingdom culture of all things. As with anything, being curious and asking questions can be done in an annoying or negative fashion. We obviously don't want to annoy people, so make sure the person you're talking with doesn't mind being interrogated a bit, and take care to ask questions in a respectful way. If direct questioning is not appropriate to the situation, then just observe and learn as much as you can. Don't judge others. There's an old saying, which I will not repeat here, about what happens when we assume things. Suffice it to say that human beings get ourselves into a great deal of mess when we jump to conclusions. This is nowhere truer than in cross-cultural contexts. When we encounter an unfamiliar cultural value or approach to a situation, it will often elicit a negative reaction on our part because that's not how we would do it. Their approach often makes no sense to us, but people rarely do things that make no sense to themselves. Withholding judgment is a vital skill for the culturally competent individual. I will not try to sugarcoat this. It is not easy to do. We can jump to conclusions effortlessly. It takes a tremendous amount of self-discipline not to. Just think, though, how many avoidable conflicts in your life have taken place because someone leaped to an assumption that turned out to be incorrect. There's a monumental difference between observing and attempting to decipher the actions of others and judging them. Judging includes observation, but then jumps forward to assigning value as well. Give the benefit of the doubt. For the longest time, it drove me nuts when my wife would take trivial things like a pen or phone charger cord, I described that struggle earlier, that I viewed as mine. I didn't mind her using things, but she would use them and move them, and then I couldn't find them. I assigned the worst possible motive. Selfishness. But as I have detailed above, as I began to pursue cultural understanding, it dawned on me that this tendency came from her collectivist cultural background. Rather than selfishness, it was a signal of love, acceptance, and inner group identification. In the world from which she came, it was a way of saying we are one people. I missed that message for a long time, however, because I jumped to conclusions and did not give the benefit of the doubt. I often wondered, how could there be a positive motivation behind taking someone else's stuff? Well, I found the answer. One of the best skills I've learned is that when I'm annoyed by someone's behavior, to find the best possibility behind the action. Someone cut me off in traffic. Maybe they just found out their child is sick and are trying to rush home to tend to them. Someone speaks rudely to me? Perhaps they just found out their spouse has cancer and they're overwhelmed. Someone walks by me on the street and doesn't offer a greeting? That feels rude, but maybe in their culture it is considered invasive to greet strangers, and in their mind they were simply being respectful of my privacy. I am imperfect in applying this skill, of course, but it saves me a lot of grief and conflict when I do. Translate actions. Once we have taken the initiative to avoid assumptions, the next step is to translate the actions of others. I've already alluded to this principle at various points in the book, but it deserves its own space and explanation. When people from another cultural background do things that feel inappropriate or rude, we do well not to jump to judging them negatively, but instead assume the best. But we can take it one step further if we do the work of interpreting their actions. Linguists will tell you that there's a big difference between translation and transliteration. Take the word baptize, for example. Traditionally, there was no word baptize in the English language. In the New Testament, we find the Greek term baptizo sprinkled throughout the texts. That word means to dip or immerse. But most English translations of the New Testament opted to transliterate the word rather than translate it. That is, they just transferred the Greek word into English and invented a new word, baptize. Over time, many faith traditions have slowly changed the meaning of that word to mean sprinkling. They can get away with doing that with the word baptize because it doesn't have a meaning in English. It is a word used nowhere outside the Bible to give it context. Had the English Bibles translated it immerse, it would be nearly impossible to justify forms of baptism that didn't involve full immersion. The term immerse has its own meaning in English and cannot be changed quite so easily. We make a huge mistake when we transliterate actions of others. In other words, we take their action and simply transport it into our cultural framework and what it would mean if we did the same thing. Thus, if my wife takes a pen from my desk, well, I would never do that. And if I did, it would mean that I didn't care about that person's things or was flat out stealing from them. Do you see the conflict that could cause? If I translate it, though, I come up with something far different. In translating, you change the word in the original language to a word that means the same in the second language. If I translate her action rather than transliterate it, I realize that she is doing something that was respectful in her culture. It may not feel right to me, but at least I know that the intention was not nefarious on her part. We cannot control how interactions with others will feel, but we do have power over whether we transliterate or translate their actions. Reject ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism is feeling that your culture is superior to that of others. This goes beyond simply preferring what you know and looks down on the practices of others as substandard. This form of pride is a surefire community killer. You can appreciate your own culture, but check your heart for ethnocentrism on a regular basis. Once it gets a foothold, it is difficult to root out. Allow each other to make mistakes. The pressure to be perfect is an unbearable load for any of us. Even in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus urges, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect," Matthew 5:48. He is not speaking of mistake-free living. He uses the term to mean complete, as he speaks of the Father's love for all, including enemies. There is no person or group that falls outside of God's love. He is complete in that, and that is the target for which we aim. We will make mistakes. We will be insensitive or rude in the eyes of another. We will respond badly to their culture and make premature judgments. We will misinterpret actions. It will happen. Count on it. I will blow it, and so will you. This is where grace comes in. This is where mercy triumphs over judgment. I've watched my sons play basketball throughout their lives. My oldest son had a coach who demanded perfection. He would yell at the players and immediately take them out of the game for the smallest errors. The result was players who were nervous, jumpy, and could never get the most out of themselves or overcome the fear of messing up. My younger son recently had a coach who was just the opposite. He did not yell at them for mistakes or take them out of the game. He would just clap his hands in a show of positive encouragement, and then later, when they came to the bench, would calmly explain what they could do to improve next time. His players flourished because they weren't afraid to make mistakes. They were willing to take risks, and they developed as young men and as players because of the environment he created. We want to create church families that encourage us to reach out to one another, to learn and to grow. But we can't set up a punitive atmosphere that reflects our world's outrage culture and jumps to conclusions, publicly chastising people for mistakes or insensitivities. Do we call out sin? Yes, lovingly and patiently. But we also understand that all mistakes aren't sins, that we all make them, and that we can overlook, forgive, and love because love covers over a multitude of sins. 1 Peter 4:8. Be sensitive? Don't be so sensitive. Down the road from where I live stands a bright new Super Target. It has a pod of doors at the entrance point marked Enter on one side. On the other side is another pod of doors marked Exit. A remarkable amount of foot traffic constantly flows in and out of those doors. When people follow the directions and enter and exit through the correct spots, it works well. If people ignore the two-way flow, things can get mucked up quickly. When it comes to cultural interactions, a two-way flow is invaluable. Be sensitive to others and their needs, but try not to be so sensitive concerning your own. This doesn't mean jettison your own cultural preferences and always defer to others. This is about level of sensitivity. When everyone in a community strives towards this dual flow of sensitivity to others and a bit of steel with their own feelings, amazing things start to happen in the community. This is particularly important in an age when so many are so easily offended. As Christians, we must not be influenced by this oversensitivity. Let the sensitivity flow to others, but not into your own life. When only some are doing this, that's better than nothing, but it will eventually wear on those who are trying. Be proactive. I have a good friend who is suffering through some significant back problems. In a response, he's working with physical therapists, stretching daily, following a moderate exercise routine, and doing everything he can to care for his back. That's all good. But do you know what's even better? To care for your back before a problem appears. Strengthen your core and lower back. Stretch every day. Do the things that experts agree will help keep that important part of your body healthy. But most importantly, do it now before problems develop. Maybe you're sitting here listening to me right now and you don't have a bad back. Start taking care of it. That's the point. That's really not the point of what I'm saying. I'm making an illustration, but just trust me, take care of your back. My wife and I have been invited into many churches that have begun to experience problems, some small and some big, in the areas of race and culture. It's good to address problems when they appear, but my recommendation is to be proactive. If you think your church is fine, start educating and training in these areas now. Take the initiative to become cross-culturally competent before you have a conflict. Commence talking with others in your group about culture and potential conflicts before they become actual events. There is no time like the present. And I'll say here that there's this interesting phenomenon where most of the churches that we hear from or that invite us to come in and speak have started to experience some conflict or problems. Every now and then, we'll hear from one who's like, hey, things are pretty good, but we know we need to work on it. But often I hear from, not as often as, you know, groups invite us in, but, you know, I do hear from churches that are like, nah, man, you know what? We're good in this area. We don't really talk about it, but we're good. We don't have problems. And there's a tendency to think, well, we don't want to start talking about it because that will create problems. I've never experienced that to be true. If you think about in a marriage and you start to have dialogue and maybe a conflict arises, you don't say, well, if we hadn't had that dialogue, the conflict wouldn't have arisen. Probably not true. The conflict was probably there or needing to be talked about or, you know, down the road it was going to hit. And so actually developing healthy dialogue in your marriage before you have problems, good communication styles and system is really, really important. I think it's the same with cultural competency and cultural humility. You have to start to learn it. Even if you're not having problems in your church, learn these skills now. Two more practicals here, and then we'll finish out the chapter. Get out of your comfort zone. The safest place to be is your comfort zone. It's also the place that will afford the fewest opportunities to grow. Becoming all things to all people, by definition, will call us out of our comfort zones. Jesus' initial call to disciples was to lay down our lives and follow him. If you want to be comfortable, you've chosen the wrong religion. Cross-cultural competency is not about comfort. It is about growth and loving others. Please take the risk. It will be worth it. You may experience some bumps and very awkward moments, but it will be worth it in the long run. Relax. Cross-cultural interactions can be anxiety-inducing by themselves. Add to that the hypersensitive, outrage culture we live in, and many of us would rather just not even try for fear of making a mistake and being called out. But just listen to Frankie. Those who grew up listening to 80s pop music know what I'm talking about. Just relax. And for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I'm sorry for you. Because that was epic in the 80s. Relax. Don't do it when you want to get to it. But beyond just a song, man, I remember in the early 80s, people were going everywhere wearing shirts like Frankie Say Relax. And it was a big deal. Anyways, just relax. Don't relax to the point of insensitivity to others, but don't be so afraid of making a mistake that you become paralyzed. Surround yourself with some brave comrades who are willing to wade into cross-cultural exploration with you and agree that you will have fun with this and treat it like an adventure. My wife and I still bump about cultural issues almost daily, but we have fun with it. We laugh at ourselves and the power that culture has over us. When we take a step back and relax, we're much more likely to learn, to love, and to grow. Well, we've reached the end of episode 33. What it looks like to be a culturally humble person. Super grateful for you joining me today. As always, if you have questions, feedback, thoughts, send them to allthingstoallpeoplepodcast@gmail.com. You can continue to support the podcast. I don't do Patreon or any of that. Decided not to go that route based on some, I think, good advice that I've been given. But you can go to Michael Burns Teaching Ministry and purchase some of the books there. That continues to help be able to do what we do. And of course, we get some great support from many of you out there already. Emotional support, and appreciate the encouragement and get some, I am very grateful to the Two Cities Church for the constant support that we get from them. And so thank you to all of you. So just help where you can, but keep listening, spread the podcast. If you can, share it with your friends. You can do that through, whatever means you do, or go on Facebook if you're not already a member of the Facebook group, the All Things to All People podcast with Michael Burns. Be sure to like that on Facebook and share it with friends and share the episodes as they come out each Monday. We look forward to you joining me on the next episode where we're going to talk about culturally competent church leaders and what that looks like. So that'll be a good time. Thanks for joining me, All Things to All People podcast. See you next time.